Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer and mixer Drew Drucker. But first of all, I was just looking at an article about the top-selling vinyl records in 2016, and I was kind of shocked at the names that were on the list. So first of all, this was a Forbes article that talked about the top three selling vinyl albums in every state. But there was also a compilation top 10. So let's start with that first and see if you notice a trend here. So number one is Purple Rain by Prince. Number two, Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd. Number three, Ziggy Stardust by David Bowie. Number four and five are Led Zeppelin albums, In Through the Outdoor and Presence. Number six is Abbey Road by the Beatles. Number seven, Appetite for Destruction. Number eight, Bob Marley, Legend. And 9 and 10, we finally get to more modern artists, 21 Pilots, and Vessel number 9, and Blurryface in number 10. So this is kind of distressing. In a way, it means that there's lots of good music from the past, and people are appreciating it, and that's always a good thing. The downside is there's not enough younger artists, newer artists, that are kind of making a dent in this part of the business. And considering that vinyl is looked upon as being so cool to own, and most vinyl owners are in fact millennials and below. It's not baby boomers, it's in fact younger people that are buying vinyl, but yet they're buying old vinyl, they're not buying new vinyl. So let's just randomly look at what's big in all the states here. Okay, just randomly, Alabama, Journey's Greatest Hits, number three. Louder House by Tool, number one. Arizona, Sgt. Pepper's, number one. Arkansas, Sgt. Pepper's. California, Nevermind by Nirvana. Colorado, Tool. Connecticut is different. It's AM by Arctic Monkeys, and that's kind of cool. But as we go along, I'm looking at every state, and for the most part, they're older records. What's going on, Marvin Gaye? A Night at the Opera by Queen in Florida. Goat's Head Soup by the Rolling Stones in Georgia, and we can go on and on. Here's Paranoid by Black Sabbath in Illinois. Iowa, Jagged Little Pill, Alanis Morissette. And we go on and on and on. Here in Louisiana, it's Lazaretto by Jack White. Okay, so that's kind of new, but number two comes in at Journey's Greatest Hits, and number three, Bleach by Nirvana. So you keep on looking at these, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense that there's no new artists for the most part. Mississippi Chronicle by Creedence Clearwater Revival. And we can go down the list and down the list. And it seems like everyone is releasing vinyl. My mastering engineer friends tell me that every time they master something, they also do a vinyl release as well. But yet, even though the major labels are putting this stuff out, it doesn't seem like people are buying it. They seem to be buying old titles. So I don't know what to make of that. In one way, it's cool because younger people of all ages, I should say, appreciate good music, and they know that music from that particular time period was actually pretty good. But in another way, it's very distressing that today's music isn't being held in the same esteem. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. The fourth editions of my Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, and Mastering Engineer's Handbook are now available on Amazon and also coming to a bookstore near you. You can read excerpts and find out more details by going to bobbyosinski.com. It's all one word, bobbyosinski.com. Now, next thing I want to talk about is a pre-session checklist. Most of us have home studios these days, and they're for ourselves for the most part, but occasionally we're doing a session for somebody else. Even if it's a friend or a band that you know really well, there's still a lot of things that you have to learn for the session in order for it to go smoothly. The one thing I hate is going into a studio that's totally unprepared for my session. If that happens, I know there's two people to blame, and the first one is the studio manager or the owner of the studio for not calling and asking what the session was all about, but I'm also to blame for not calling and telling them. So these are some of the things that the studio should know before your recording session. First of all, what type of music is being recorded? Because it makes a difference between how loud it's going to be, how soft it's going to be. Is it going to be acoustic? Will there be baffles required? All those things center around the type of music. How many songs do you expect to record? If you expect to record a lot of songs in a shorter period of time, that approach is way different than it is if you're going to spend some time just on one song. Because what that means for the most part is you have to set it up almost like a live gig in order to make the songs go very fast. And also it's the approach, how quickly you're going to record and what you're going to accept and not accept is good enough. Who are the musicians? Because that might affect the setup. So it behooves the studio owner to know who the musicians are. If you know who some of the musicians are coming in, you already know what they like and how to set them up. Who's a producer if you're not talking to them already? Well, producer's important because, once again, there are certain preferences. You know certain producers work a certain way, like a certain setup. So the more you know about the producer, the more it tells you about the session. What time does the session begin? This seems like pretty elementary stuff, but the fact of the matter is, if someone says the session is starting at 1 p.m., what does that mean exactly? Does that mean the downbeat is going to be at 1 p.m., or does that mean that everyone arrives at 1 p.m.? Well, most pros know that that's the downbeat. However, if you get a young band coming in the studio, and if you tell them 1 p.m., they may think to just get there at 1 p.m., so you have to be crystal clear on that. How long do you expect the session to go? A lot of times we can't tell in advance, but usually you can get a feel for what people expect. I always tell everybody, look, 7-8 hours is enough for me. Beyond that, we may push it a little more, but not that much, because I've found that no matter how long you go, unless you're under a deadline, you absolutely have to get something out. The longer you go, things are actually going to get worse instead of better. So it's better off to cut things off at 7 hours or 8 hours and come back fresh the next day rather than actually slogging through it just to get some parts down that you might replace anyway. How many musicians will be playing at once? Well, that of course really makes a difference on the setup. If you're going to have a full band playing, that's way different than if you're just having a drummer coming in with a vocalist and a guitar player as accompaniment that you're going to replace later. So it really makes a big difference, and you should know that in advance in order to have that set up correctly. What's the instrumentation? Again, big difference between a four-piece that's all acoustic and a traditional four-piece rock band. So you really want to know that. If you just say, hey, there's four musicians coming in, that could mean just about anything. It could be, you know, jazz musicians coming in with all acoustic stuff. So it's way different. So you got to know. How large is the drummer's kit? How many toms will he be using? I usually encourage drummers to really pare down their kit if they're used to playing a big one and just come in with a couple of toms, a rack tom, a floor tom, and maybe two rack toms if you really think you need it. But for the most part, I much prefer a smaller kit. However, there are some drummers that really depend on their big kit. They have to have the humongous kit in order to get their sound or in order to do what they do. So you have to know about that because it really makes a difference in the available miking and what you can use, how you can use it, and what's available for everything else. Will a guitarist be using an acoustic or electric guitar? So again, it might be both, but you have to know that in advance. And what kind of amps are the guitar players and bass players using? Are they going to be using big Marshall stacks? Are they going to be using just small 15-watt pig-nose-like amplifiers? Are they going to be using just a pedal into the console going direct, which we're seeing more and more of, so you have to ask the question because it could be quite a variety of answers. Do the players expect to use the house gear? Are they bringing their own? Or do you have enough gear to actually accommodate them and accommodate them in a way that they really want to use what you have? How many cue mixes are required? Nowadays, everybody gets their own cue mix, and it's pretty easy to do that. Once upon a time, if you had two, you're going pretty well. But today, everybody likes to have their own. That being said, just because they have their own, it doesn't necessarily mean they know how to set it up. So if you're the engineer, you better go set something up basic for them all first and then let them tweak from there if you want it to go quickly. Is the band going to be tracking to loops? So in other words, do you have to have the loops in advance to integrate them into the session so the drummer or the players can hear them as they play? Is there going to be a scratch vocal that's going to be tracked at the same time? Some bands don't need that. Most of them do. Once again, it's best if you do the best you can on a scratch vocal because you never know. It just might be the best performance you'll ever get. So I always make sure that it's as good as I can make it and never intend on doing another one, even though it almost always happens, because you just never know that maybe the one that's the keeper. So this is just some of the information that should be transmitted between the producer or the leader of the session to the studio owner before the session begins in order to make it run smoothly. Because if you don't communicate that information, you can find that it can cost you a few hours. And if you're paying for those hours, it might be a lot of dough out of your pocket. If you were going to show someone how to make it in the music business, you'd point to Drew Drucker as a perfect example. Drew graduated from recording school, then worked his way up in the business by starting as a runner and moving up the ladder thanks to hard work, paying his dues, and some really good timing. His client list includes some of hip-hop and R&B's biggest stars, including Wiz Khalifa, Juicy J, Travis Barker, Bruno Mars, and Be Real, among many others. I spoke with Drew via Skype from his home in Los Angeles. Tell me about your journey from LA Recording School to where you are now, because I bet it's interesting.
Well, I started at the LA Recording School when it was still called The Workshop. And while I was attending, it got bought out by Full Sail. So when I was there, it was only a 9-month program. I finished it in 11 months after like holidays and all that kind of stuff. That was breaks. And what it really gave me was an opportunity to do internships. So I got two different internships, one at 4th Street Recording, Santa Monica, and one that's now called Nightbird Studios. It's in Hollywood, the Sunset Marquee. It used to just be called the studio at the Sunset Marquee.
Yeah.
And they're both completely different styles of studios. So it was a kind of a good experience. One was kind of like a bougie, upper echelon, just high scale, and the other one was more of like a grassroots rock and roll kind of vibe. So it was good to have both experiences. And then after that, I got a job running at Paramount Recording Studios, and they own American and Encore. And so that was just a bunch of different rooms that I kind of got my chops up in as a runner and an assistant, an engineer, and so on. So it's been quite a journey. That was in 2005 when I got my first runner job. So quite a while ago.
Yeah, you can think of it like that. Or you can think, wow, it was just yesterday. It doesn't seem that long. Yeah. I guess
it doesn't seem that long ago. And I mean, I was 19 when I got the job at Paramount. I couldn't even go on alcohol runs. So I'd have to bring somebody with the crew with me to purchase booze if that was a run that was needed. So it was a good experience, huge learning experience. And I would accredit most of my learning as engineering, production, and everything to just being in the studio as opposed to, you know, anything I learned at school, which was a signal flow chart. And that's pretty much the level of knowledge I gained from the school. Still important, but, you know, All of the knowledge was gained pretty much on the job.
Did you get a staff engineering job there?
I did. Yeah, I was a staff engineer for a while. And that's how I ended up linking up with some of my larger clients like Wiz Khalifa. That was Atlantic had rooms, like kind of production rooms booked. And I was kind of a sub engineer for Atlantic because I was a staff engineer at Paramount. And then when Wiz ended up booking the studio, they called me just knowing that I had worked with Atlantic Urban Artists before. And that's kind of so how I got out of staff engineer. But I started as a staff engineer, and they pretty much, I kind of got pigeonholed more towards urban and pop and R&B sessions. But I definitely did some rock sessions and some classical sessions and just everything that they threw at me, kind of.
Was your big break?
I guess you could say that. Yeah, I had that's my big break into like becoming an independent, fully independent from the studio kind of situation. As a runner, what kind of got me off of the schedule was a session with Scott Storch. He was working with the Clips on a kind of like a group album they were doing. And they asked me to assist it, and I said, sure, of course. And 24 hours into the session, the main engineer kind of checked out. He's like, I'm leaving. The PO isn't covering any more overtime. It's just way too stressful. So he left. I took over as the first thing engineer 24 hours into it. And then 6-7 hours into that, Scott was like, I was just vibing with him, kind of, you know, nodding my head, doing all that sort of thing. And he's like, you want to mix this record? seems like you know what you're doing. I was like, sure. I didn't think anything of it. And like 5 days later, the record label called me and said, Scott says that you're his mix engineer and wants you to mix this record. So I went from a runner to an assistant to an engineer to a mixer within like 1 week.
Wow.
I was so out of my realm. I actually hit up one of my assistant friends who was mentoring me at the time. He had never had a mix credit either. And I was like, you want to help me mix this song? So we kind of co-mixed that song and both got our first mix credit. So that was what got me off of the runner schedule onto the engineering schedule, though. And then Wiz kind of got me my first platinum records that the label picked up for me, kind of, so to speak. You know, I worked on some other things that were platinum and gold, but the, you know, as a staff engineer, they're kind of on to the next unless they pick you up in their crew, mm-hmm. you know? So they're not necessarily looking out for the staff engineers like they would, you know, their own engineers, you know? And that's kind of something that I think is like evolved when people start sending tracks over the internet to do features. It's like, good luck getting credited on recording that feature, you know?
Yeah. Well, okay. So you run your first mix and I guess you felt a little overwhelmed. So it was on the job training. So how did you learn?
Well, you know, it was just a matter of, you know, studio downtime, just going in and just kind of shadowing all the assistant engineers and the other engineers who would let me sit in their sessions. And then as far as mixing is concerned, that I, you know, more or less taught myself via in the studio, learning all the techniques and kind of just bouncing ideas and reading books, but just being in the perfect mix environment, being at Encore Studios gives you a lot of leeway as to what music is supposed to sound like. So referencing other good mixes, referencing records that were recorded and mixed at that studio that then went on to have huge success gave me a good like focal point of like, okay, my stuff needs to be this caliber, you know, this much space, this much oomph. So mixing, I kind of just learned through trial and error at the studio. Engineering and tracking was definitely a lot of information that was passed down from all the other assistants and stuff, but I never really worked as an assistant to a big mixer, kind of like that trajectory as an engineer.
Yeah.
I never had the mentorship from the big mixer. I never assisted Dave Pensado for 4 years or anything like that, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of the mixing techniques was stuff that I just kind of had to pick up along the way. But you know, having that traditional background in the studio, getting to assist some big sessions that, you know, full board automation sessions where they roll in five racks of cartage, definitely gave me a good like understanding of how people use certain techniques, but it was more like passed down through the chain of command, you know, because I'd be in another room and stuff like that, you know.
Was there an aha moment for you when you were learning how to mix when you all of a sudden went, okay, I think I have this now. I think that was that little thing that I needed, and now I have it.
Yeah, there's definitely a few moments. And, you know, when I started mixing some of the first rock projects, learning how to mix on urban music, that there was some aha moments real quick just on how to mix bass better and drums differently and stuff like that. And then, you know, I'd say just starting to, you know, really just figure out a way to get the drums going fast and then have the vocals sit perfectly with the kicks and snares and not fight. Cause in rap music, it needs to have that super high energy from the drums and the bass, and then the vocals, the next most important thing, you know? So that was just, you know, being in the studio and just constantly just referencing other records that were how records were supposed to be. And then I'd say, you know, in the beginning of when I started working with Wiz, cutting hundreds of songs and then having to rough mix those in 10, 15 minutes is kind of what made things click for me, like how to mix vocals really fast. And then the beats things kind of just came along, mixing the music kind of just came along with it. And then I'm, you know, I'm still learning how to make everything better. So still learning new techniques, still implementing new technology, always trying to just stay one step ahead of the game, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned before about there was a difference between mixing urban and mixing rock, and there was a moment there when you figured that out. What did you figure out?
Okay, so like, you know, mixing the bass guitar when I was first mixing that rock project about 9, 10 years ago, it was like I was just trying to mix it real heavy, you know, kind of how you would mix a sub bass or an 808 kick drum. And then I just started digging into it more, and then I was like, oh, you know what? What I usually would get rid of on a sub bass, you know, around 400 to 300 to 400, 500 hertz, adding that on the rock bass is where it needed to be, you know, where the bass needed to be. So that was kind of an aha moment. And then just spatialization with the drums, because, you know, you're usually using static sounding samples with hip hop music, you know, repeated over and over. Maybe there's some swing and maybe, but most of the time there's not a whole lot of space in the drums. It's just a lot of mono sounds or fake stereo sounds, you know? And so with urban and rock, you know, rock drums, there's all this space from the room that it's important to tame that space. And then, so learning between the two and then implementing the style of some of the urban stuff that I do into the rock stuff. That way it sounds unique too, and it has a different style. That way I'm not just mixing it like how a Metallica record was mixed, or, you know, I try to like push the boundary of said genre by implementing mix techniques from both urban and rock into each other, mm-hmm. without making rap rock by any means, but just like, you know, how a drum break would sound in a hip hop record, figuring out, okay, this breakdown section, I'm going to filter the drums out to make it sound like it was a vinyl hip hop break. And then that's just like a 2-bar piece before a chorus drops, and then bring the full spectrum of the drums back in. Stuff like that, filtering. There's a lot of filtering going on in urban music now, where you just take all the top end off a beat. That's just something that people don't do in rock music that much, just completely put a pillow over it. But if you do that, that brings your music, that adds a whole nother dynamic to the rock song, you know? And so I'm trying to, whenever I do rock music, I try to add a new modern dynamic that's not really like the normal approach for an engineer or a normal approach for a rock song that just has 10 guitar stacks, you know? Definitely trying to think outside the box and just using techniques from all genres to just implement it into one greater scheme.
As you're telling me this, I'm thinking to myself, you know, that would work really well for big stack guitars when you have a lot of guitars. And it's something that I never considered. I mean, you think about rolling off some of the low end because, you know, you have some stuff down there that you really don't want sometimes, but you never think about pulling a lot of the top end off and stacking them that way, which it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And I mean, and you can definitely, and just for even automate, you know, into the bridge section, just muffle it out. And it sounds like the music's coming through your neighbor's wall. And that's like a real popular thing to do in rap music right now, is to just muffle out the whole instrumental, and the chorus comes in real wet, real dreamy. And then a drop happens at the end of the chorus, boom, right back to the full spectrum. And so that, doing that type of automation that would be done in electronic, dance, hip hop, pop, R&B music, implementing that into rock music just helps bring another element to the table. And I think rock needs that, you know.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot has changed. You know, if you go to NAMM, it's like the same things. You know, rock music is not pushing the boundary of technology like it once was. So that's kind of what I like to do, is just push the boundaries of technology, push the boundaries of my computer. If I have analog stuff I can work with, if I have the time and the luxury, I'll put it through a whole guitar pedal, you know, whole pedal board, whatever, take it out of the box and implement the new effects. But, you know, sometimes in urban music, it's about the timing. So it's like, there's artists nowadays that do an EP in 4 days and put out hundreds of songs a year. It's crazy. So keeping up with that and trying to mix completely traditional is not always the safest bet, you know?
I actually love that, because when I first started, everything was quick. It wasn't necessarily because we wanted it that way, but it was because you didn't have all the technology to deal with, and you had a limited number of tracks, so there wasn't all that much to do. But it just meant that you never got bored, because or you never got into to something that was way, way, way drawn out because technology kind of limited all that, you know? That was cool. But I'm glad it's coming back to that. That's very cool.
Oh, it definitely is. And I think it's not the technology, it's more of the budget, you know?
Yeah.
So people, instead of working on, you know, one album in a month, they can work on two mixtapes and an EP and a there's a lot of collaboration going on where, you know, a couple of my clients, they collaborate together on an EP, not really a group, but like, you know, their own branding together, like on one project. And that just is, you know, keeps both brands going and keeps their music relevant without having to dilute their singular brand, you know?
Yeah.
So
when you first started mixing, I assumed that you were mixing on a console, those first mixes, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, an SSL 4000.
Okay, so when did you transition to the box?
I'd say once technology allowed me to afford it. So, you know, there was a time period where you had to have a tower and you had to have tons of, you know, DSP-based plugins to be able to do a real in-the-box mix. And probably about 2 or 3 years ago, I started getting into the Universal Audio stuff. So the UA and the satellites, right now I'm running 20 cores.
Oh.
Out of the box. Yeah. So I'm doing all my mixes on a 13-inch laptop, but with 20 cores of UA. So that allows me to literally put an SSL channel on every single, you know, every single main source. So I wouldn't do it on every background vocal, but on my subgroups, you know, kick, drum, snare, everything's got an SSL. So I start like I'm mixing on the board because that's how I learned.
Yeah.
So I'm starting doing the same things I would with just the SSL plugins, maybe then slowly inserting some additional limiting and additional compression. And then once I've, you know, starting to really things come alive, that's when I'll implement, okay, this needs a whole nother look, a whole nother texture, and start really, you know, kind of messing the sound up, I guess, in a good way. Mm-hmm. You know, I like adding all the, you know, whatever would be, you know, analog distortion and overload, but trying to figure out a way to find that sound in the box, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, what I like to do, experimenting, you know, just nothing that can quite compare to just the workflow of having them spread out on a desk.
Yeah.
But then my clients will be in a business meeting when I need a mix approval. And then that's just it's not an efficient way to work, you know?
Yeah.
So if I had my own desk in my own room where I could just leave chain set up, you know, and then kind of use the board as a summing with some additional analog features going on, then I probably would. I have a hybrid, full hybrid mix, but as of right now, I'm kind of just in the box for travel purposes, for, you know, fixing purposes. Oh, you need a new TV version, you need a shortened show version. I'm doing a lot of that stuff that maybe a DJ would have done or music director would have done on the road. I'm making all of those edits. So
okay.
I had to pull up something that was done 4 months ago because they have a new show that they're doing and they're getting a special guest feature for that show. So it's like, okay, I need to make a new version. Put it on Dropbox. Here's the link, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of that going on.
So what's your setup like then? You mentioned right. You have a bunch of satellites. You have like an Apollo or something as well?
Apollo 16. I have a Dangerous Monitor ST. I'm using Proax 100s, and then I got a matching sub using a Bryston for that, and then also NS10s. So those are my main mix monitors. I do have some Fostex 6301Bs for just testing, you know. And as far as analog stuff, I have, for mixing, I have two distressors, a Fatso. They're these EQs. They're kind of like, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, Avitus EQs.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
They're real nice. They're kind of like a 550, but have much more top end. They go all the way up to like 24 kilohertz.
Yeah.
So add some cool textures with that. And then I have a Purple 1177, an LA-4A, and some standard audio levelers. Then I have a whole pedal board full of effects that I occasionally reamp things through. try to just bring some other new textures to different things. But that's only when I have the luxury of time. A lot of times clients, you know, they need two mixes done a day, three a day because of deadlines and stuff like that as well.
So how long is your typical mix?
To take to mix?
Yeah.
Anywhere from four to like 16 hours, I'd say, depending on the song. And then, you know, a lot of times with urban music, the hardest part is matching the three or four different artists on one beat. And all those artists have recorded their verses in different rooms by different engineers on different setups and microphones and different levels of compression and room noise. That's the one of the most challenging parts. So that's sometimes with urban music, that's what takes the longest, is getting that chorus texture, getting the different verses to match and sit well with each other if I didn't record them all. If I recorded them all, I can kind of just pop them in, do what I normally do, and it all comes kind of quickly. But if another engineer who's, you know, or the artist themselves recorded it in their bedroom, which is a lot of times the case, you know, it's getting their vocal to match the quality of the artist's vocal that I recorded in the big studio is the challenge, you know. So that sometimes that takes some reamping, putting it through some extra analog gear, sending it through a same chain that I would have recorded it on.
Yeah.
Then doing my in the box mixing, you know. So there's, it just, you know, it just totally depends. But, you know, urban music can come together really fast if you have a good production and a good recording.
I was just going to ask you if you're mixing only or if you're tracking as well, but you answered the question. But let me ask you a question then. When you're tracking, are you normally in a big commercial studio or is it just done?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
For the most part. Occasionally, we record on the road, and that can be done in any manner, from a bus to a hotel room to a real studio on the road, which isn't the same level as, you know, LA, Miami, Austin, New York, kind of, if you're in somewhere in Ohio. But, most of my clients like the service of a big studio. You know, I could get that sound pretty much almost anywhere nowadays for tracking. But as far as the service, you know, it's kind of like going to a nice hotel where people are taking care of you and you got your towels fluffed and all that kind of thing. So my clients, they do really like the service aspect of it. And there's a lot of other business meetings that are happening that are not tracking or song or album related. You know, most of my clients are entrepreneurs as well, so they have different meetings there to kind of show off, you know, play their records real loud, talk about what other big albums have been done in the studio, et cetera, and that kind of being in a big room helps with that sell for sure.
Always has.
Yeah, it definitely does. And then, you know, bring the clients past all the plaques and then into the room, you know. And then one of the artists who worked on the plaques that's in the hall is in the room. Yeah. That, you know, it all, it's kind of just part of the song and dance, I guess.
When you're tracking, do you have gear that you bring or does it matter to you? You just use what's there in the studio.
Well, I've figured out a technique when tracking urban because of that. I had my own Manly and Purple when I first started, but that wasn't the best sounding rap vocal chain. And so what I learned, be it at Paramount, they have Paramount, Encore, and American all built different times, all acquiring gear at different times, started to notice a massive difference between compressors. And so what I decided to do was move to the Distressor. At the time, Distressors were 5 years old or something like that, at the oldest, you know, at least the ones in all the studios. And so every Distressor pretty much, now they're starting to sound a little different because of wear and tear from room to room as I go. But at the time when I moved over to the Distressor, every single one to me sounded relatively the same. Mm-hmm. And so I would just go Neve to Distressor in whatever said room I was in. And I trusted Paramount's tech at the time. And all the Neves were constantly being serviced or constantly, you know, being looked after because I was one of the main things being used in the room, especially in a pop and R&B session doing vocals. You just need the nice mic pre to work mostly. So that's kind of where I implemented. And then I ended up buying my own Distressors, and I'll bring those to a session if I'm in a studio where I don't necessarily know what's there or trust the room, I will bring my own vocal chain. But I'll bring a Manly mic pre instead of a Neve.
Mm-hmm.
But use either a 1073 or, you know, just kind of, I like the 1073, but Manly sounds good too. You know, it just depends on what I'm working on as well. You know, rap, I try to keep it relatively similar because I've noticed we'll do first verse in Studio A at Paramount and, you know, do the second verse at Studio B at American 2 weeks later and then do the Queens at Record Plant. Mm. So in order to like, you know, figure out a way to do that, I decided to move to Neve to Distressor. That seemed to give me the closest, easily dialable, you know, I could just dial it in, match the tone and move to the next.
Yeah, got it. How about microphones? Do you bring your own mics or do you rent them in or how does that work?
Yeah, so for a couple of my clients, I had them purchase their own mics. So it's their microphone and they'll bring them to the session from time to time. I prefer a Telefunken 251. I actually like the new Telefunken USA one because for rap music, cleanliness to me is more important than the warmth and the extra character of a vintage mic.
Mm-hmm.
And notice some of the vintage rental 251s in LA are just kind of haggard from being rented and have a lot of noise and have a lot of, you know, top end sibilance issues. So I really do like the Telefunken USA 251. And if there's, you know, nothing, no tube mics around, I'll go to a U87 for a rap vocal. But I definitely like the 251 the most. C100's okay too, depending on the artist. If you have a really sibilant artist, that's not the best mic because just picking up every S
yeah.
and every T so precisely, which can be good or bad. So I definitely like the 251. It helps just round things out a little bit. 67 is also great for rap vocals, though.
You know, as we speak, David Bach from Bach Audio was on my podcast, and he builds some really nice clones, and he's really a microphone guru. He learned how to speak German just so he can read the old Neumann manuals, so that's how into it he is, yeah. But I asked him, I said, okay, so how did you figure out which is the best sounding 251 because they all sound different for the most part.
Yeah.
And he said he went out and he got 9 of them from all the rental companies and went through all of them and figured out which were the best ones, which were modified, which weren't, and then did it like that. Yeah. And I thought, well, that's the only way you can do it because they're all different. Every time you get one, it can't really depend on it sounding the way you expect.
Yeah, it's kind of like that was the problem I ran into with the 1176 when I moved to the Distressor. It's just like, wow, these all sound completely different. And if I were to pull up my settings from compressor from Studio A versus compressor from Studio B in the same building, completely different sound.
Yeah.
So, you know, and mics are definitely the same way. And that's why I like the Telefunken USA because it's just a little bit closer from mic to mic.
They're new, you know? Yeah. So they don't have chance to get old. Okay.
Exactly.
What's your favorite plugin?
Singular plugin?
Yeah. Well, is there one that you always use no matter what?
Yeah, the SSL channel, Universal Audio SSL channel would be, I use it on every piece of every instrument that is by itself. I put one on at least. And so that's definitely one of my favorite plugins. And then I guess one of my second favorite plugins would be the Oxford Limiter.
Mm.
Just helps. Just they're the enhanced that does something to the harmonics. I'm not really sure exactly what's happening there, but some of the harmonics that happens on the Oxford Limiter is just incredible. And then another plugin I guess I couldn't live without is the Thermonic Culture Vulture.
Mm, yeah.
Universal Audio. That does add just a crazy warmth. And, you know, you can take it real extreme distortion or just subtle. And then there's a nice, you know, there's mixing and there's filtering on it. So it's like you can really dial in your, like an analog overload with that. Put that on my drum bus, put that on a music bus. So I couldn't really mix as quick without that thing for sure. It does a lot to the drums.
How about your mix bus? Are there plugins that you always use?
Yeah, definitely. So SSL, you know, stereo bus compressor. I've been using the Manly stereo mastering EQ, the Universal Audio.
Massive Passive.
Sounds good. Yeah. Massive Passive, yeah. That sounds really good. Helps a lot with, you know, the giving kind of like that GML top end.
Yeah.
That, you know, I learned how to like boost just the air on, so I could kind of do a little bit of that. It's not quite as pronounced as, you know, a GML, but it definitely helps. And then just kind of, I can get rid of some muddiness and just, it's a great plugin. As far as, I've been using the Shadow Hills mastering compressor too, but dialing that in is a whole nother beast, you know, so I'm still really, really like learning the intricacies on that one. Yeah, so I guess the main compressor would be the SSL one. And then I like to add some final limiting too, just to kind of glue everything in. And I'll use the Universal Audio P1, I think it's called. It's just a basic limiter. It's kind of like an L2, like a break wall limiter.
The precision limiter, yeah, right.
Precision limiter, yes.
My favorite too.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. So that's just to kind of add that final, just glue, make sure no transients are hitting too hard, stuff like that. So I'm not hitting it too hard by any means, but it's definitely helps just glue everything together.
How about effects? Are you a reverb guy or a delay guy or both? Because some people kind of lean one way or the other.
Oh no, I'm heavy on both. Extremely heavy on both. So my reverb, I'll have at least 3 or 4, sometimes even 5 reverb and returns. So, you know, I'll have a plate. I use the EMT plate in the Universal Audio, and I'll have like a room. Then I'll have a spring, and I do a lot with the spring. I do a lot of reverb throws to the spring. So, you know, in rap, for example, at the end of each rhyme stanza, you know, they'll say a word and then the rhyme word, and that will hit again every, you know, two to four, one bar, whatever. I'll hit those stanzas with the reverb throw, and that kind of just helps add some excitement and jumps and helps the vocal jump out a little bit. Or I'll just, you know, on the rap stacks, when they're stacking those words, those emphasis words, I'll just drown those out in some spring reverb instead of putting a lot of reverb on the lead. And that helps just add some contrast and some space to the vocal. And then with the delays, I'll have a half note, a quarter note, and an eighth note, usually H delay waves. I've been trying to replace it with something Universal Audio just for power purposes, but I just have yet to find something that does the same thing with the same ease, because I automate the crap out of this plugin. So I'll automate the feedback, I'll automate the filters, I'll automate the modulation, and that way I can add some crazy outros, and I'll do a delay throw, and then 30 seconds later that delay reappears because I'm slowly raising the feedback. And then that vocal appears, and then I can have that, you know, kind of disappear with modulation and filtering. So I really, really love the H delay, and I automate 5 or 6 parameters sometimes on that plugin. So I have at least 3 of those set up. And then I'll have, you know, some just additional kind of delays occasionally, like a Echo Boy. Mm-hmm. And that would be more of an effect delay, you know, something that will change from song to song, where every single song that I mix has at least a quarter note, eighth note, half note somewhere. Whether or not I'm using a half note on every single mix, it's there because it's just part of my mix setup, you know?
Yeah.
And then the Echo Boy, those parameters will be a little bit more varied. And then I like to have a slap delay too, just in case. And so because of all the power that I'm using, it doesn't really eat up my system. So I'm bringing in, you know, 15 tracks of effects just in case, you know, and that way they're already set up and I could just boom, boom, sit, you know, harmonize that, modulate that, add a doubler to that, as opposed to like, maybe this needs a doubler. Now let's create an aux and then make the doubler. So it's a little overkill, I guess, on my setup when I first pull it in, but I use 75% or 80% of the effects that from my setup every time.
How many tracks is your average mix, just out of curiosity?
So rap, you know, it's less.
Yeah.
And the beats are anywhere from, you know, as little as 8 tracks of music, all the way to as big as, you know, 24 tracks of music. But rarely am I getting big orchestrations in the rap genre. When I'm mixing R&B, it gets a little bit more intensive because there's live instrumentation on top of static instruments. So, you know, 48 tracks would be on at most music. And then I'll sometimes, you know, print those down into subgroups. You know, if it's like a bunch of string stacks, boom, put that into one stereo, submix that. And then vocally, you know, so I guess in rap, you know, you have one lead vocal and anywhere from 2 to 4 stacks of, you know, ad libs or rap stacks. And then the hook is anywhere from 1 to 10 vocals. So, you know, I'm looking at anywhere from 24 to 48 tracks, 64 at the most in a rap song,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's going to be a real commercial rap song if it's got more than 64 tracks, like a real, they're shooting for top 40, you know, they're shooting for the radio. Where, you know, a lot of rap, they don't care about the radio. They care about the club. They care about the homies. That's, you know, so it's a different level of expectation on certain genres of rap. So kind of like, you know, punk rock versus Steely Dan.
Right, right.
You know, so both are kind of happening at the same time, but certain emphasis is put on, you know, like what's happening in rap now. It's very much punk rock. So, you know, kids making beats on their laptops, completely overloading the stereo bus, but it's the sound that they're liking. And so I'm having to tame this kind of like, there was an aha moment, like you had mentioned earlier, when working with an artist where I was like, damn, why am I trying to vocal produce him like I would a top 40 artist when he's really punk rock, you know?
Yeah.
And so I kind of had to make that correlation in my head. And rap is starting to evolve into that. So there's super commercial rap. There's, you know, whatever's happening right now rap. There's like the punk rock scene, which is kind of what they're calling a trap. And so it's, you know, just implementing new technologies and then kind of just going with the flow of what's happening.
The first rap thing I did, which is a long time ago before it actually got big, I remember the guy came in, can't remember the artist, but he came in and he did this rap 4 minutes long. And I did what you normally do at the end. I said, okay, you want to try to beat that? And he kind of looked at me funny. And he did it exactly the same the second time. Yeah. It was exactly the same. It's like, well, okay, I guess you can't beat it.
Yeah.
It leads me to a question. Are you doing multiple takes when you're recording a rap vocal and then comping them together?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah. And then certain... every artist works a little different, obviously, and I could try to vocal produce till I'm blue in the face, but they're going to do what they want to do. So I have to kind of go with that. And sometimes certain artists let me vocal produce them 100% and tell them exactly how many stacks they need, where to fix a word, where to even take out a word if there's too many syllables. So, but then other artists, they have their ways. And so then I kind of just work with it. But definitely, you know, we'll do exactly what you said. Hit a whole pass down. Maybe he'll stop in the middle, punch that, get a whole 16 bars or 12 bar verse that he wants to do. Then we'll try to beat it multiple times, you know, and then we'll revert back to the first one, you know, 50% of the time. But, and then other artists, there is no going back. You know, Wiz, for example, he'll kind of rap what he has in his head, whether it be 2 to 4 to 6 bars, kind of get that out of the way. And that kind of starts the verse. And then in his head, as he's listening back, we'll come up with the next parts, punch the next parts till they're perfect. So we'll punch it again, but there's no going back to the previous playlist, even though I'm saving every playlist, you know, we'll have 40 playlists by the time we're done, but he's never asking me to going back. That's just for my own safety. You know,
yeah.
My own peace of mind, just in case something happens and it's like, boom, I could just sneak a word in, he wouldn't even notice. But he's very particular, so he's not going to move on until he's happy with it. And then once he's happy with it, it's done.
Yeah.
There's no, I think I could rap that verse better. You know, he's confident in that when it's done, and, you know, the only thing we'd go back on and fix is would be something that's like a movie company's like, you know what, you should change this line. It would help this scene a lot better. And just to make the producers happy or something like that, he would do it. But if it's for his music, for his album, there's no fixing it. There's no going back. But, you know, definitely other artists will fix and want playlists. So I playlist everything regardless. But we definitely, you know, it's not quite as extensive as a singer, you know, 40 takes on a verse or something. And then you're building the best take out of those 40 takes. Yeah. You know, it's more of just they're trying to get the best energy, you know, and they want the breaths and they want the realness to the rap. It doesn't, you know, having it sound too perfect is not what rap is about. You know, it's definitely about get raw. So, yeah. And then you're getting into the Flo Rida, the really big, you know, Macklemore stuff. If it's like, if it's not raw, it's that. So it depends on who you are as an artist and how you want to be perceived is important when recording.
Yeah,
for sure.
Are there any current trends that are happening?
Oh yeah. In rap music, people are making beats on Fruity Loops. Almost exclusively. You're getting to the big producers will have their the old school setups or like, you know, their ways, but it seems like all the young dudes, they're either in Fruity Loops or Ableton and they're overloading the crap out of the stereo bus with the brick wall limiter and their bass as well. And so, you know, their 808s don't sound like an 808 from an 808 machine. They're just being smashed through all hell processing. And that's kind of the sound. And then it's up to the mix engineer to tame that super squared out wave file and have it be something that's, you know, commercial ready, you know, ready to compete on the airways kind of thing. But that's like the sound. So that's why I mentioned the punk rock thing, kind of completely overloading their amps, you know,
yeah,
messing what's technically not right is what's making the genre.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's like those full on happy accidents or just, you know, the lack of knowledge of like the traditional knowledge, you know, which would lead people to not do something. They're doing that and that's creating a whole new sound. So which is kind of interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Last question, Drew.
Mm-hmm.
What is the best piece of business advice that you either learned along the way or maybe somebody imparted to you?
The best piece of advice, I guess, would be to just never stop learning. First off, you always want to keep learning and staying up with the technology and staying up with just new everything. Because the technology, I think Brian Eno said this, the technology is the sound of the generation. So if you listen to each decade, it changes with the technology, not with the people. So the artists themselves move from decade to decade, changing with the technology. You know, and you, even Kanye West is a good example of that. Obviously, like there's, you know, a more apparent rock and roll from the 60s to the 70s to the 80s. That's a huge difference. But even Kanye West started out making beats on MPCs and ASRs. Now he's implementing new technology. So I think constantly learning and constantly wanting to be on the forefront is, you know, the business advice that I would give is just never stop learning, always be a student, and, you know, just always trying to push the envelope of what is currently happening instead of just falling in tow with what's happening. Take that and then push it further, push it past, and try to just, you know, create something new and create something that'll last the test of time.
If you want to find out more about Drew, go to drewdrucker.com, DREWDRUCKER, all one word, drewdrucker.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.